Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Reveille, reveille, donks. Look at us now, tip to tip. This is our life. This is our passion. That's the spirit we bring to this show.
I'm Luke Thomas.
I'm Brian Campbell.
This is Morning Combat.
Oh, yeah. Get yourself fired the heck up. UFC 299 this Saturday, Miami. And this is Morning Combat, back from the dead, ready to invade your face hole in the most consensual and gross way possible. I'm Brian Campbell. That's Luke Thomas next to me, the 1-2 punch that has raised many awards. Luke, is that a Sean Price t-shirt?
Boot camp's best.
There it is. There it is.
Brownsville, Brooklyn. Right there.
Looks good on that washed middle-aged guy who's getting unwashed at a rapid rate right here. Hey, Mikey Mormile of CBS Sports on the ones and twos. We told you we'd be back. More to come on our future, and it's going to bang hard, Tui. But there's so much to talk about 299. Here's the first question to kick us off, Luke. Is this a better card than UFC 300? I got to get an answer from you.
It's not a better card, I don't think, overall, BC. Here's my view on this. It's not a better card, top to bottom, although it's close. Number one, it's close. It's very close. But I think the real kind of difference here for me is that 300 has an inordinate amount of expectations. Nobody has any expectations for 299 other than it's a big market now. Didn't used to be, but it is a big market now in Miami. And it's a pay-per-view for the UFC. So there will be some expectations as to what the fans view as a reasonable effort by the UFC to put together a pay-per-view. But relative to what they expect for 300... that's actually pretty low. So to me, 299, see if this makes sense, BC. 300, there's so much scrutiny about making sure every slot is maximized in the way that that particular slot should be from the main event on down. 299 feels like just a big party. It doesn't feel like there's these grand expectations about it, but because it is so good and it is so stacked, people have, I think, a very charitable, correctly, but charitable view of it. In some ways, that's a little unfair to 300.
Well, either way, whichever way you lean, 299 is deep. That's the calling
card. It's fantastic.
Cards.
It's star power galore. BC, let me ask. For we always get killed for being sometimes unnecessarily negative to the UFC. Forget about is it better than 300 or is it not. For me, ready? See what you give me your grade. Here's mine. It's an A+. This is an A+. I'm not saying that there couldn't be other A+s that you'd like more. For me, as a card, this is an A+ card. Very much worth your money all the way through.
You're damned right. We got depth. We've got big-time star power in the return of the Sugar Show and the Bantamweight champion Sean O'Malley in a bitter rematch. We've got maybe the last ride of Dustin Poirier. We've got the first octagon visit for Michael Venom Page. And there's some sleeper fights that are going to absolutely kill the night. We know it. Yeah, I'm talking about things like Gilbert Burns versus Jack Della Maddalena. But Luke, they come for the marquee in these parts. And I think they picked a perfect main event. Not just perfect for Miami. Not just perfect when you look at who are really the stars right now that demand our attention across this promotion. And who is the right dance partner that is going to jack it up. Obviously, Chito Vera versus Sean O'Malley, part two. This time, though, for the Bantamweight title is worth the price of admission. Heck, I thought it could have even been the UFC 300 main event because of the personalities, the styles in play, and the history. So, first question to kick off to you about this main event Is Chito Vera here because he earned it, or is he here because he's the only man to defeat the champion of the sport's deepest division?
It's a little hard to make the argument outright that Chito Vera is the most deserving of this. It's the matchmaker model that the UFC uses. It's not a tournament. And so we all know the score. It doesn't necessarily mean that everyone who gets a title shot was the most deserving of it. It's hard to argue when in 2023, about a year ago, March of 2023, Chito Vera lost handily to Corey Sandhagen. So does that really make him the rightful guy? Probably not. It does not. But listen, this is not the only consideration. It's perhaps the most important one, but it is not the only consideration when any matchmaker decides to put a fight together. One thing, BC, that I believe has been lacking in Sean O'Malley's expected star turn has been, to what extent did he have a rival? And Jan was something of a rival, sort of. It was a grudge match, kind of. It was a controversial result, but that was part of a bigger Jan period of decline, so it didn't really stick. You know, and he obviously beat Aljamain Sterling fairly straightforwardly. There was nothing to really build off of there for any kind of second fight. But this is one that they could actually go back to. There was some controversy about that first fight. I think some of the storylines that were very present during that first fight are no longer present. So this is, to me, the UFC actually not going to the best available contender, but one that still poses interesting questions, makes it so you think that there is a competitive fight on our hands, potentially anyway. And if the UFC is banking on a potential for future for Sean O'Malley as a continued presence in the championship role, these kinds of fights are going to get him there a little bit quicker, perhaps, than some of the other ones that he could be that he could face. So it's a mixed calculation, but it's not one where it's like utterly bereft of value in terms of its competitive grounds. There's still some value there.
3.5 years since they met the first time. It was back in August of 2020, and as we move ahead on the calendar, of course, a lot has changed, particularly in the career of O'Malley, who was able to rebound from that loss and go on this incredible streak in which he upset Petr Yan by split decision, or maybe, I'm not sure exactly where the odds were in that one, but it was a coming-of-age victory in many ways, and then he goes in there and does exactly what he says and knocks out Aljamain Sterling. So when you look at the odds at the moment from FanDuel for this main event, plus 210 Marlon Chito Vera, your underdog, minus 280 Sean O'Malley. So, Luke, when we go back to 2020 and the first meeting, the only loss of Sean O'Malley's career, we know how often publicly, whether it was just to motivate himself or part of his marketing for T-shirts or what have you, he says the loss never happened. It doesn't really count. Chito got lucky, and he wins that fight 9 out of 10 times. Luke, I doubt you're going to fully agree with that. But are there enough elements of truth that to that statement that you almost throw out the first fight and the results of it entering the second one outside of the obvious marketing pull and the fact that this is a rematch of his only loss? What can we actually gain from that first fight is my real question.
I think that the general contours of what this fight might look like will match some of the general contours of that one. The thing that I do believe there's a little bit of merit to, actually a fair degree of merit to what Sean is saying. Not, you know, does he win 9 times out of 10, BC? I don't know about that. I mean, that's to me a little speculative. I guess we'll see. We'll see how we can get better information on Saturday. But I guess here's my point. BC, what was one of the biggest storylines coming out of that fight? It wasn't just from that fight. It was that and actually some other ones, but it was magnified by this fight. It was that Sean O'Malley was brittle. It was that Sean O'Malley did not have any durability. He gets injured. It's easier to hurt him physically to the body. He simply won't last. That was a big part of the storyline of that fight. And that is in deep contrast to Chito, who is like arguably the best chin and the most durable dude in the entire UFC pound for pound, right? So there's a massive contrast. But dude, that story, you know, if that was around the Tarion Ware or the Sukumtat fight for Sean O'Malley, that storyline just isn't present anymore. It's just not there. You just don't hear people after what, I mean, you can say maybe Sean O'Malley did or didn't beat Jan, but either way, no one, that ghost is no longer following him to this point. And actually, since that fight, I think it'd be a tough argument to make that actually it is Chito Vera who has improved the most. It is pretty clearly Sean O'Malley who has improved the most. So does he beat him 9 times out of 10? I don't know. But is he right to look at, hey, a lot of what people were saying about what I was up against there just hasn't really borne out at all since that time? Yeah. Yeah, actually he does. I think he does have a right to feel a little bit that way. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and he's really, really put his entire career together. I mean, you mentioned maybe Vera is that rivalry that he's always lacked. I would say that's beyond his traditional former rivals, which are USADA and monogamy, Luke, but he's, you know, overcome both of those battles. So when we talk about O'Malley and his evolution, like I said, watch the Jan fight, watch the Sterling fights. You can see what happened. Chito, though, is 5 wins, 2 losses since their first meeting. He lost a clean decision to Jose Aldo. He lost a split decision, which seemed to be much wider when you watched it live, to Corey Sandhagen.
That's not a split decision. That was insanity. He got wiped out in that fight. I mean, he did.
No question. What would you say he has done now at age 31 in the 3.5 years? Has he gotten better? Has he evolved? Yeah. We've seen highlight reel knockouts of Dominic Cruz and Frankie Edgar, for example, along the way.
Yes, there's no doubt in my mind. So just because Sean O'Malley has made more progress in no way means that Chito has made none. Chito's made progress too. He absolutely has gotten better. First of all, I think he's a devastating leg kicker. I think he's a very good body attacker. But really, what's the Chito Vera magic? It's that he is insanely durable. He has a rock chin, and he can turn it on in the 4th and 5th rounds. And if you're not prepared for the deep waters against a guy who's hard to hurt and surges late, dude, good luck to you. You're going to fucking need it. That's really what Chito Vera excels at. It doesn't mean he's necessarily the best bantamweight. As I mentioned, just a year ago, we saw Corey Sandhagen more or less using wrestling and control, ground and pound, run the table on him. So I don't know if that's an avenue available to Sean O'Malley, but we have seen that it doesn't mean that Chito is the best bantamweight. But it might mean stylistically that he's got a lot of potential problems that he poses to Sean O'Malley. We don't know that exactly. We'll have to see. But it does seem that like it's worth considering and it's worth taking seriously. So I think he's sharpened up his Muay Thai. He's found a good system for him that works. This is a 5-round fight, which works much better for his style than 3 rounds. And his defense overall has gotten better. He's become more judicious and thoughtful about shot selection. And as I mentioned before, already has the kind of durability you can't buy it. You can't work on it. You can't find it. You either have it or you don't. And he's got it in spades. To me, it's going to be a really interesting test. If this fight goes past the 3rd round, what's it all going to look like? I'm telling you, I know Chito Vera is going to be there. Will Sean O'Malley be there? We shall see.
Yeah, we'll see if that brittle reputation from their first fight can hold up. Obviously, it was an injury that, I guess, opened the door for defeat for O'Malley. But when you do look back and watch it, man, we've seen that injury before, right? And it happened in the fight because of the fight. Chito jumps in top position, raining ground and pound clean. I get what O'Malley's saying, but I also watch Chito go in there and do what he does. When he gets you hurt, he gets you out of there. That's the truth in this situation. So, Luke, as we look at this fight, can Chito win it outside of a knockout, outside of hurting and dropping O'Malley multiple times? Is Chito skilled enough over 25 minutes to do this the other way, the hard way?
I don't think a decision is likely for him. So you're going to have to win 3 of 5 rounds is basically what that means, right? If you're going to go to a decision, you have to win 3 of them. 2 of them, I could see a window of 2. 3, that seems possible, but that seems like a lot. Especially if, you know, he's down the first 2 right away. You got to win the last 3. That's tough. I actually feel like his best way to win would be to stop O'Malley with a surge that he just couldn't endure late. That seems to me the best. Because, like, again, the Sandhagen route of wrestling, we're talking about Chito, what he could do. But I just mean, I don't think that, like, he's going to out. I mean, do I think that Sean O'Malley has the best takedown defense in the division? No, but it's pretty good. Aljamain Sterling has some trouble with it. It's actually pretty good. And I don't know that Chito's got better offensive takedowns over the consistent amount of 25 minutes that he's going to need. So it's really going to be about just, can he weather again, could go a number of different ways, but a probable scenario, the one that I think seems to be the likeliest, is that he has to surge late and what that looks like, trying to walk Sean O'Malley down. Can you get enough sustained offense there? It's a bit of a narrow window, right? It's like, can Chito be that quarterback to like really thread that needle? You know he can do it, but the odds are not great, but possible. That's kind of the scenario I'm looking at.
I wonder if he benefits, and I'm talking about Chito Vera, from the tension between them. Now, I wouldn't call the build up to this point. We're recording this on Wednesday of Fight Week. I wouldn't call it overwhelming or you know, drawing people by the numbers in just because of the ill repair between them. Obviously, the storyline sells itself. O'Malley star power sells itself. Chito is a fan favorite in the violence category without question. But do you think we'll see, as Fight Week progresses, that bad blood play out? I'm wondering if that fuels Chito. I wonder if he could benefit from that, is really what I'm saying here.
They're both too I doubt it. It just doesn't seem, neither guy seems to be especially impressed with the other guy, you know, rather than like enraged by them or triggered by them. They both seem to be kind of recognizing it's good business opportunity, but otherwise bored by the other guy. So I don't exactly think that that's going to do it. I really believe that, like, to the extent there's any intimidation or any kind of withering, it happens because of what happens in the octagon itself rather than any kind of other factor. But, you know, well, I don't have the best eye for that kind of thing either.
I am feeling a bit of the O'Malley star turn, and I don't know if you're feeling it too, Luke. I'm feeling it because my dad, who probably has never heard of Brock Lesnar and still thinks the UFC is a bare knuckle, no rule sport. The only fighter he knows is Sean O'Malley, who he calls Shane, that Irish kid who looks like Noel Redding of the Jimi Hendrix Experience. And that's the reference I constantly get from my dad. Hey, is that Shane the Irish kid fighting again? Have you felt like, since becoming champion, that we have seen the star turn up to the level that we expected of O'Malley?
No, I don't think we have, right? So, like, I mean, just, again, these are very different scenarios. And BC, I know you love all of my tweets about Ilya Topuria in Spain. I know that.
Oh, I haven't seen any of them, Luke. I see. I've been following Ryan Garcia's Twitter feed most of this week, so I've been ignoring you, to be honest with you.
Who's this crazier? You know, my fascination with Real Madrid in Spain, or Ryan's just psychosis?
Yeah, I'm not going to answer that, but I get your point.
But yeah. I guess what I would say is, BC, at least here's the point I'm trying to make. And you saw what Drickus in South Africa to an extent as well, where they get these guys go to their home nations and they're like rabidly embraced in a way that's like kind of shocking, you know? So what that means for the popularity over here, it's kind of hard to tell in both of those cases, but it just felt like something was different for them after those moments. I don't know if we've seen Sean do that. I mean, here's the thing, right? I mean, this is the kind of issue he is navigating, it seems to me. Tell me if you agree, BC, and I mean this in all seriousness. On the one hand, has he stood out by like the colorful hair and like the tattoos on his face, and he's got this crazy neon look at all times, and he doesn't look like anybody else, and it looks very different, and some people like it, some people hate it, some people think he's trying too hard, whatever, but it definitely stands him apart. The thing about Drickus and the thing about Ilya Topuria, it's that when they went home, it seemed like the mainstream was like all too ready to embrace them. I feel like Sean O'Malley has kind of set aside a path for himself that's very unique and very much apart from the mainstream. But I feel like that's also creating some distance between them, right? Like, it's making it a little bit harder for the sporting public to come back around to a guy who just looks utterly different from what any kind of sporting hero that they've ever been accustomed to. Would you agree with that, or am I off on this?
No, I think you're right. I think it's also sometimes the product of where we are in media at the moment, meaning when we look at how it used to be done, how a star went from breakout performance to, man, the UFC or any other promoter is pushing them, and look at, they're everywhere. It tends to be through the idea of like media tours, press conferences, the ESPN car washes. Oh, they got a commercial deal. Okay, like they're being pushed in front of you. I think the difference today, especially with a guy like O'Malley, excuse me, who seems to be ahead of the curve on the idea of having your own YouTube channel, basically just selling your brand constantly, is that's a model where they're going after certain groups. And it might not be the groups that we, as 45-year-old washed dads, as we always say about O'Malley, like, O'Malley's pretty cool, Luke, but there's a lot of that's lost, maybe an age transition or
for
translation.
Sure. I mean, we're two fucking idiots in their 40s, you know. I mean, that should be very clear to everyone for up front.
But between his connection to live streaming video games and then the idea of, again, him having his own channel and people can come right to him to get their, you know, their dose of him, I wonder if he's not, just because it's a different model, going directly to these different age groups or
you know, yeah. But hold on. Let's talk about this for just a second. Like, okay, fair enough. I mean, let's be clear. He is popular, right? We're not saying he's not popular, but your question was, is it where we thought it would be? And I think the answer is no, it's not there yet. But by the way, if he keeps winning, it almost certainly will be. You know, I want to say that very clearly. And two, he is popular. He has, as you mentioned, his own YouTube thing, and he's got his own like digital army and presence, and he's in control of his own message. For sure, there's a lot he's doing right. But like, you know, there was a video of Drickus, and he was out in front of this gigantic rugby stadium, and the stadium was apparently electric for him. And dude, Tapuria met with the fucking Prime Minister of Spain. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, that's what I'm talking. And he was on
the most popular show in Spain.
Like, what I'm saying is, have you seen O'Malley on, I don't know, Rogan is more popular, but in terms of like that Middle America thing, have you seen him on Jimmy Fallon? Have you seen him on those? That's what I'm talking about. Yes. Like, that connection is missing.
I also don't see, though, to be fair, we talked about it a lot, the UFC doing that model anymore. Put, you know, making sure that they're behind it and making sure he's getting on these shows. Sometimes it's more of like fighters.
If they had a guy popular enough, they would. If they had a guy popular enough, they would push it.
It's interesting to think about in the changing scheme of things, but definitely he's lived up to expectations in his biggest fights, and that's what it was always going to be about. So as we now turn the direction toward this rematch, the main event Saturday night, do you feel like you have a firm grasp of exactly who O'Malley is as a fighter? And I ask that only because close win over Petr Yan, like split decision against a former champion, but he's been able to sort of ride his A game. He goes in there, forces Aljo into a mistake, too aggressive, squaring up, coming at him, gets him the hell out of there. But there has always been soft comparisons to Conor McGregor in that sense. When McGregor kept winning, as all the haters kept moving the goalposts and saying, okay, well, now if we get a wrestler on a full camp, we'll see what he looks like against there. Do you feel like you know exactly who O'Malley is and that he really can go out there and beat any style in this great deep division?
I think at age 29, he's really settling into his offensive system. There are some comparisons to Conor McGregor in the sense that he's a guy who manages distance really well, fantastic timing, can find the half beats in between any kind of connection. You saw that against Aljamain Sterling, accurate, good power, you know, the kind of guy who can use movement and angles to create traps, guys walk into them, and then he drills him. He's really, really, really quite good at that. And as I mentioned, his takedown defense, it's not impenetrable, but it's very good. His scrambling is good. He's not trying to beat you with his jiu-jitsu, but he's trying to make your jiu-jitsu very nullified, and he can do it in a full array of ways. Like, he can play the game as far as he needs to. And I think that, you know, what sets him apart, like, what does he do that's really great? It's aforementioned. It's the distance management. It's the timing. It's the power. It's the accuracy. If you can really refine those skills and put it together in a coherent striking system, which I believe that he has, he's a phenomenal feinter, by the way. Like, he sells it very well. That's hard for anyone to deal with. When he's fighting on his terms, he's tough to beat. He's tough to beat. You got to take him out of that. He has to be tired, or he has to be wrestling for really long stretches or something like that. He has to be injured or something. Once he's out of that system, it's a different ballgame, you know. But in that one, he is excellent. He's very good.
He is, and it does seem to have the game necessary to beat these super elite, well-rounded guys, because he can hold that distance control, because he can prevent the takedown, and because he does have that delivery system to hit guys with strikes they don't see coming. That's why this fight's so great, because as you laid out earlier, Cheeto's got a chin and a half. What if he is still there in the championship rounds? What if he's not falling for the feints? What if he's taking O'Malley's best shots and still coming? I hope, Luke, that we find out those answers in the cage on Saturday night, meaning that this one does go into rounds 4 or 5. It is an action fight, and we have to see O'Malley dig deep into that bag of tricks in ways that he hasn't had to up to this point. Like, if he is going to be the guy that he's looking to be, then he not only has to redeem this loss to Cheeto, but we think of that often as, okay, go in there and knock him out, redeem it that way. I want to see him redeem it in the way that you pass all the tests, because in a weird way, Cheeto's here, yes, more because of their history than his spot in the rankings, but he might be that perfect kryptonite opponent of durability and utter violence that he can test Sean O'Malley in ways that no one else in this division potentially can. Maybe, Luke.
Styles make fights, dude. I mean, again, Cheeto Vera is not the most qualified candidate for this moment right now. He's not. But the way in which he matches up with Sean, at least we think, could create for some very interesting answers to questions that we have. We'll see.
All right. If you're Merab Dvalishvili and you just fought and you just scored the biggest win over your career in Henry Cejudo, and it has been announced, or at least rumored, that Marab's going to show up and weigh in on just a few weeks' notice here as the backup for this title fight. But he knows he's in the on-deck position to fight next. Luke, what are the odds here? And I'm not talking about the betting odds. We already laid that out. I'm talking about in the mind of Luke Thomas, how much of a striker's chance or what have you that Chito Vera is going to end the Sugar Show and welcome Marab for the first title defense. Like, if you're Marab, what are you thinking right now, Luke? What is Luke Thomas thinking? Can Chito Vera do the impossible here a second time? I don't mean impossible, but unlikely, I guess.
I want to say that this is not impossible. Like, what Francis is trying, like, oh, I'm going to knock out Anthony Joshua in the first three rounds. That's also not impossible, but pretty goddamn close. You know, this is not that. This is improbable, difficult, but doable. It's doable for Chito. I just don't think it's likely. I think it's likely that Sean O'Malley is going to get his hand raised. I wonder if we might have some drama to the extent that it goes long, but let's posit another scenario. We're all talking about Sean's imperfections or where he's fallen short, but imagine he like shines here and he puts Chito away, you know, which would be like historic in its own right. That would be incredible, right? I mean, he hasn't had the kind of performance, like the Aljamain one was great, but Aljamain was not popular as a attraction among the fan base, and so I think that kind of limited what the value of that was. Chito was not necessarily a huge star either, but to be able to like put a guy away like Chito would be remarkable for him. And at 29 years of age, he should be at the peak of his powers or pretty close to it, right? So there's a lot that's on the line for him there, but I do think of all the likelihoods, him getting his hand raised, probably be a decision, not stoppage, is the likeliest.
Yeah, I like O'Malley here in this main event, but you got to see it happen. You got to see him go through this test, get to the end of that video game and defeat that boss. And that boss is a badass from Ecuador, Luke, and he is coming on. Great main event for Saturday. Can't wait. But Luke, would you say the main event is the fight you are most focused on heading into this card, or is it something else?
Again, fight's pretty great. I mean, people aren't even talking about the fact, and this is not my answer, but people aren't even talking about the fact that Curtis Blaydes is fighting Gelson Almeida on the like
big fight.
The prelims of, like, just shocking the depth of this card. But dude, the future of Dustin Poirier and what it means for a guy outside of the top 10 and Benoit Saint-Denis to be fighting him is a big, big deal. That one, you gotta, I mean, that's a 27 versus, what is it? I think it's 27, something like that. 26 versus 35. It's just a huge fight.
28-year-old Benoit Saint-Denis, Luke, who has not seen defeat in five fights since his UFC debut in 2021 when he lost a decision in Abu Dhabi to
Eliseu Zaleski dos Santos. But I think that was up a weight class.
You did nail that. That was a welterweight bout, and Zaleski was deducted 1 point in round three due to a groin strike. The result was contested by Saint-Denis, says Wikipedia. Like, since then, Luke, five straight wins, five straight stoppages. He submitted Ismael Bonfim when he had hype. He knocked out Thiago Moises and Matt Frivola in consecutive fights. He's so coming on, if you will, right now. I don't know what this tells you, but I watched the full 45-minute UFC countdown show for this. They showed pictures of Dustin Poirier. They mentioned him, but they did the deep dive, family camera time, get wife and kid, go to the shooting range. True story. Benoit carrying in his baby to the shooting range. And they followed him like he is the next potential big thing in this star-studded lightweight division, and obviously a guy that they can continue to make inroads building through Europe and coming out of France. The only thing is, Luke, he's fighting like an American hero in Dustin Poirier, one of the all-time greatest fighters, and seriously, one of the all-time greatest UFC fighters to never win an undisputed championship. Yet, I don't know if the quote came directly from Poirier, but I feel like this week we're talking about, is this the end of the road for Poirier? Almost more in some ways than BSD is even being pushed as next. UFC pushed him a lot, like I said, on Countdown, but like, that's the central tension of the matchup. Which one is more true in your eyes? The idea that BSD is this irresistible force who has arrived on the scene and, like Taporia, is ready for instant stardom? Or is it more likely and more about the storyline that this great action warrior in Poirier is going back to the front lines once again against the next big thing in line, and this could be the end? I mean, Luke, I don't know how you're going to answer that, but which side of that coin is more pressing in your eyes entering this one?
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I mean, it's the same coin, right? One's one side, one's the other. Like, I see them as equally relevant. I mean, again, if you didn't even know anything about Dustin's career, you didn't know anything about Benoit St. Denis' career, and then I just sort of read to you the basic facts. It's a 28 versus a 35-year-old. The 35-year-old, by the way, it's at sea level, but the 35-year-old is coming off of a head kick loss back in July, you know, and all these other sort of factors that you could throw in there. You would not like his chances. You'd be like, I don't know how I feel about this. I mean, 28 years old, that's when you're beginning to enter the peak of your powers. You know, the first two wins he had in the UFC, Denis, I did not find super impressive because there was a lot of just ferocity that he has. And again, I was skeptical on him pretty early. I've come around a lot more, I should say, of late, because he still has an incredible fire in his belly, but he's really beginning to put a thoughtful game together. And man, that is just an absolutely potent combo that just cannot be overlooked. So to me, this is one of the, I mean, there's actually several fights on the card like this, BC, but this one really defines generational struggle at lightweight. We all thought it was going to be the guys like Armin Saryukin, and it still might be, but you know, we thought all the different Georgian guys who were coming through and the Gamrots, and those guys are knocking on the door, but here comes out of France, Benoit Saint-Denis roaring through the division, getting someone in the top five when he's outside of the top 10, everyone kind of being okay with it, you know. And for Dustin, I feel like there's a little bit of echoes of Volkanovski, where he got the head kick KO and came back. That was much quicker. And again, this is the championship level. He was up a weight class. I mean, there's a lot of dissimilarities, but I just, there's shades of that I kind of feel like about this. And also, BC, this is a game we play on MK, and I think it's a very valuable exercise. What is the promotion trying to tell us by booking a fight like this? Right? What are they telling us about who they think is coming, who they think is going, who they want to prop up, who they might be done with? What are they saying? Now, again, you don't want to read too much into it, but BC, this roaring Frenchman who is action fighter to the nth degree against a 35-year-old coming off a head kick KO. They're kind of telling you what they think.
Yeah, and also Poirier's lost two of last three by stoppage. Obviously, that other loss to then-champion Charles Oliveira. He only fought once a year each of the last 2 years. He's 35. Let's be honest here. I'm not asking for your prediction on this fight, but if I told you I could see the future and Poirier gets finished inside of two rounds, which would obviously catapult BSD, you would probably assume that you would advise him to walk away at that point, right?
I would, yes. I mean, I think this is a guy who, better than most, has been good with his money. He has, again, say it one more time, you've never heard of someone give you, other than Colby Covington, you've never heard someone say a bad word about the guy. You've never seen him get in trouble, nothing. Been a, you know, his foundation is, what we can tell, thriving. I don't know him as a person, but I feel like, you know, he's got other streams of income that he's worked on, the hot sauce and everything else. There's a lot going right for his career. Also, we should say something, BC. An interim champ, finished Eddie Alvarez, finished Michael Chandler, finished Justin Gaethje, and then defeated and finished, two times he beat him, finished Conor McGregor. Guys, that's as good as a career is ever going to get without holding an undisputed UFC weight class title. That's as pots as good as you're ever going to get. So he's done a lot, BC, but we're talking about a guy who was in those kinds of fights. And now he's taking on someone who is 28, still very much unknown to a big portion of the American fan base. Yeah, it's not looking great, is what I would say. It's not looking great.
Yeah, I mean, he's up there with Dan Henderson in that ongoing bridesmaid list of the best UFC fighters to never win the full championship. Obviously, you'd throw Fedor in there if you're talking non-UFC and beyond. But I still think he's the first ballot Hall of Famer for everything he's accomplished and what he represents and how he carries himself. I was starting to talk myself into the idea that he was getting old a couple fights ago, but you know, then I caught him out, had a Chandler fight, and that Chandler fight, which was absolute chaotic theater, Luke, he comes out of there the last man standing, looking like, you know, $1 million fighting through hell once again and pulling off a gnarly win. And then he gets early head kicked in a BMF rematch. So it's like, what do you do here? Who is he? Where is he at? When you're at that age, sometimes it can be hit or miss at the highest level. And on this fight, I do consider the highest level because BSD is looking to be of that ilk. So look for Benoit Saint-Denis to become of that ilk, for him to literally catapult himself into the top 10 of this division and start knocking on the title door. Does his game have to raise it to another level in this matchup? Or do you think what he's shown in this five-fight win streak is potential to be a handful for aging Poirier?
Should be. Yeah. I mean, again, the times that I had a little bit of skepticism is he was still really raw, you know? And again, he has just in... I mean, I've said this before. Just pay attention when he scrambles like in the Frivola fight. You can go back and watch it for as long as it was. Pay attention to his scrambling. I mean, the instant he gets an underhook, he's moving. I don't know how to explain this to folks, but there's a lot of people that are just not like that at all, who don't have this kind of absolute fearlessness to, you know, every one of these positions is a conflict. He has unrelenting commitment to fighting through these conflicts piece by piece by piece, and like with no hesitation whatsoever. I mean, that can wear on a guy. That is, it tells you a lot about his fighting spirit. I mean, there's so much to it. But he was kind of raw for my taste. I didn't really love how defensively irresponsible at times he could be. And he's really cleaned that up. And that's not to say there's not any concerns, but it's not what it was a few years ago. It's much, much better. And so what I would say to this point, BC, is what does he need to defeat Poirier? He needs to put heat on him. He needs to absolutely melt him and make him wither. Poirier is going to be inherently, I think, a little bit defensive, but the reality is he's got big power. He is a veteran. He is skillful, I think, in many scenarios. BSD is probably going to have to, one, really just absolutely... I think standing at range for too long with Poirier is probably a mistake. So to me, I think you're going to see a lot of takedown attempts, but not just that, where like the takedown is fought off, but then you're pounding on the guy when he's in turtle and you have a tight waist, that kind of a thing. These like transition positions where he's leaning into the ground upon. I think he's going to have to use a lot of those kind of positions to really get ahead and mix it up. And I think, BC, the other part too is that fire in his belly, it's not just useful because, you know, he can power himself for as long as the fight goes. I think he might need some resiliency. Poirier might hurt him, right? I mean, it seems pretty reasonable that Poirier might be able to find his chin a time or two, and he's going to have to find a way to rally through that. So to me, this is a real generational battle. It's a kind of thing where one guy has more overwhelming firepower than another guy, but the other one could sharpshoot his way right through and make things difficult for him. So it's about finding that. But to me, I think there's going to be a lot of wrestling, transition positions, ground and pound against the wall, such as you can call it, that kind of a thing.
Yeah, let's look at the odds here from FanDuel. Minus 215, Saint-Denis the favorite. Plus 164, Poirier seems reasonable. I do like the younger rising fighter in this matchup. I didn't want that to be the case, but when you watch the tape, Luke, you start to look at where they are. This does set the stage for one of my favorite tropes in MMA, which is the aging hero to you know, turn back time one more time and remind us who he is. I'm cheering for Poirier in that regard, but you do eventually need to see the handoff, and we've seen it in the featherweight division. We might see the beginning of it here in the lightweight division. My final question on this, unless you want to regale the crowd with a pick here, Luke, is...
I'm picking Saint-Denis.
Okay. When Dustin Poirier came out and did the whole, hey guys, just so you know, like this fight isn't signed, and it brought up this another big debate, and you know, is that the UFC's practice, blah, blah, blah. He found a bag in that scenario, right? Like he leveraged his position to get what he deserves. This is true, right? In hindsight, we're going
to
say that.
Yeah. I mean, he doesn't deserve to be doing charity for any promoter at this point, right? I think we're past that. So
hostage in a way against their own dirtiness.
I think he forced their hand more than holding him hostage. I think he forced them to act in a way that he preferred. Yeah.
Now, if you ended up finding out that it was Hasbulla that purchased Bloody Elbow and then fired everybody and took down all the controversial true stories that they've written on there, would you laugh a hearty one, Luke?
That would be kind of funny if Hasbulla was like the mastermind behind the most dastardly plot in MMA media history. Yeah, maybe.
There you go. Hey, great card. We got to roll on here, Luke. This welterweight tilt is what I love about UFC matchmaking, right? Kevin Holland against the Bellator debuting Michael Venom Page, ex-Bellator, obviously, welterweight title contender. Thought he got robbed against Logan Storley. Could have been an interim champion. But at age 36, he's making the leap. I caught up with him. Check that interview out if you haven't. YouTube.com/morningcombat. Great chat, Luke. We had that room service diaries with him in London. That was so nice to see him get this type of close-up now. I love the pre-fight videos on Countdown or Embedded to see MVP giddy. You know, he's talking about how professional the UFC machine is and how he knew this moment was going to be here eventually for him in his career. Do you find it interesting at all that they didn't on Embedded, they didn't mention the word Bellator once nor show a picture or piece of video from his time there? There was a lot of regional stuff. There was this man came from another organization. That almost feels like an unnecessary jab. Like they won the war. Bellator's barely like hanging on through PFL now. Like, what are we doing here, Luke?
There's no juice to that fucking brand. I mean, how many times do I need to say it? Their brand is dead. That brand is super cooked.
Can't they just say former Bellator star? I mean, like,
so
they do that.
I agree. Point. I agree that at this point, it seems unnecessarily, you know, stomping on their grave at this point, because it would help people to see some of his cool. I mean, the dude. BC, like, seriously about this, when he shattered the forehead of Cyborg Santos, Evangelista Cyborg Santos, dude, I was like legit worried that guy was gonna fucking die. I mean, or something, you know, I don't know. Like that, I'm not proud that a guy suffered that kind of trauma. I'm just saying, if you're looking for highlights, that's up there. I mean, that shit went mega viral.
The Caveman Rickles fight. Luke, he told me, my MVP in my interview, that's the ultimate highlight of what he does great. He was basically Anderson Silva against Forrest Griffin in that fight. He was just moonwalking.
So I'm just saying, like, it would have been nice to have that, but honestly, are they gonna, he's 36, dude. They're not building him. I mean, his time here is limited. I don't think they care all that much in that sense either. And I understand that.
Well, Kevin Holland's a perfect foe in the same way Cowboy Cerrone was the perfect foe for Eddie Alvarez's debut. Was it Dan Hooker who was Chandler's debut in the UFC? It's sort of like those tough outs, guys that are on the verge of contention. Kevin Holland is in that space, certainly, yes, in his reinvention at welterweight. If we look at the odds right here, minus 138, Kevin Holland, a small favorite, plus 108, Michael Venom Page. I got to bring to light this bet I've made here, Luke, with CBS Sports senior editor Brandon Wise, friend of the program. What do you think about this bet? You ready for this, Luke? Straight up, okay? I'm picking MVP to win. He's picking Holland. Loser has to buy a KevinIoli.com t-shirt or hat and make it their social media avatar and make it their picture on Slack for a month. That's a decent bet right there. That
seems like a highly consequential bet. I mean, yeah, I'm not sure what you're doing with that one.
A lot of skin on that. Yeah, a lot of skin on that one, Luke, right? Loose skin. You know, that's an interesting bet, right?
I don't quite get it, but yeah, fuck all that. I wouldn't do that shit. That's action I would stay away from. I think you might have to get your.
You're nervous.
I think you might need to get your credit card ready.
You're no Rampage jokes. R.I.P. Please, Luke. Not Rampage, Rumble, dude. I can't even figure out my old tired jokes all over again, Luke. I know a lot of people have apprehension here, not just in the stigma of a Bellator fighter coming over and doing it. We've seen guys do great. We've also seen Will Brooks, unfortunately, have a tough time. But there are a lot of people who say, man, Holland's the wrong style, wrong guy, wrong time for someone with a flashy game that's looking to finally come on the brightest stage and prove themselves. I think that'll raise MVP to another level here. What are your expectations within that? How people look at MVP and say, hey, man, you can do that spinny shit against Cyborg Santos, but like, this is Kevin Holland. This is the real deal, Holyfield. What are your expectations in whether he can raise his game here in this debut?
See, here's the thing about Kevin Holland, right? He's real talented. Like, he's real skillful, and he's gotten better about, like, using it in a thoughtful way over time. But, dude, he'll still fight down to his opponent. Do you remember he likes to high-five people and shit and, like, you know, just kind of tries weird shit he shouldn't be trying when he's, like, shoulder rolling and moving out of the way.
He does a podcast during the fights, basically, Luke. You know,
yeah, I mean, yeah. He gets real chatty with everybody. And so it's like, I think if Kevin Holland had a Benoit St. Denis attitude, I wouldn't have really any hesitation picking him, you know. But because he could fight fucking weird, I actually feel like MVP's got a real shot here, to be honest with you. MVP, remember, he didn't look great against, well, he looked great early against Mike Perry, but then got outdogged late. He's 36, so that's not great. But, you know, in his comeback fight against Goichi Yamauchi, he, like, shattered his fucking kneecap. Like, the most gnarly shit I've ever seen, with not counting him shattering the skull of Cyborg Santos. So, like, that was a real nice win, which they should have shown that one. That was the one they should have, like, gotten off the couch for. But I'm just pointing out, I don't think MVP has the overall skill set that Kevin Holland does, particularly in the submission department. Like, you shouldn't lose sight of the fact that he actually, I mean, remember, he submitted Michael Chiesa not too long ago, but you have fight down to competition, and that makes it to me a 50-50 proposition. Really,
I think that's why the odds are where they are, because I fully agree with the way you laid that out. Even though Kevin Holland's record can be up and down, and in particular, Luke, he is 4-3 since moving back to welterweight full time. And we praise him for the reinvention there, but he's also taken fights last minute that maybe he should have. Those three losses, two by finish, they were consecutively, one to Khamzat Chimaev in that last minute moment at 279. And of course, the Stephen Thompson, when he was unable to come out of the corner after four rounds, also is coming fresh off a close loss by split decision to Jack Della Maddalena, who's also on his on this card. He does play down to level of competition. He does play into parts of the fights that he shouldn't in terms of bait. I wonder if MVP can bait him into a flashy contest of staring each other down, feinting, trying to throw shots. And, you know, you don't want to be in that contest with MVP because that's where he lives. So to neutralize that, do you see Kevin Holland exclusively shooting and looking to wrestle? Because no. I could see him hanging too long in the pocket, Luke, and that's when you're going to open up the room for MVP to do Michael Venom Page stuff.
Dude, there's no doubt in my mind he's going to slug it out with him, you know. I mean, I'm not saying there will be no defense, but I'm saying I just don't find it likely he's going to shoot. You might say he should, and that he might do well if he did. I'm just not taking that bet. I'm not taking the bet that or you know, he might shoot or something, like if you're actually taking a prop bet or something like that. But like, is he really going to put to what you're asking, which is sustained wrestling offense? Like, really, this is how I'm going to fight this fight. No, I just don't believe that. I don't believe he's going to do that. But remember, he can punch. He's got good power. You know, he's durable as shit. Like, you know, he is tough. He's a real tough dude. I'm going to say it again. Kevin Holland is a skillful fighter. You just don't know what kind of mental approach or strategic approach he's going to take fight to fight. So it makes him fun, but it makes him a wild card.
Absolute wild card. And in a lot of ways, that's what MVP is, a wild card. He's won a lot more than he's lost, right? But he can be a wild card too. Love this matchup. Love this for MVP's debut. Let's see if he's here for a short, good time. Chandler-esque. It's not going to be long at 36, but he has not looked like he's slowing down up to this point. We stay in the welterweight division, and this low-key might be the best fight in the card. Seriously, this is going to be an absolute war, because Gilbert Burns, especially in the second half of his career when he's lingering in his 30s, but he's not falling off. I know he had that tough loss to Bilal Muhammad, which he hoped was going to lift him back into the title picture. He took it on short notice. He was injured. We remember that situation. But, dude, Gilbert constantly has ways of reminding you how violent and viable he still is at all times. Jack Della Maddalena, fresh off the split decision win over Kevin Holland, is in his sights. The 27-year-old Aussie, 16-2 overall, has not lost in six UFC fights after winning on the Dana White Contender Series. Luke, this matchup is so good from the standpoint of who's coming or going. Is Jack on the level to make that leap into title contention? Does Gilbert still have it in the tank? I think any way you look at it, we are going to see action here. You talk to Gilbert Burns. What can you glean from that, separate from an incredible story about Topuria knocking out sparring partners at Sanford MMA? I mean, just incredible.
So that aside, I mean, dude, you know this as well as I do, BC. We've interviewed Gilbert a couple times in person. This one was obviously via Zoom, my last time talking to him. But, you know, one thing I always walk away from, and I know you feel the same because we've actually talked about this previously, dude, Gilbert is a smart guy. You know, and what I mean by that is he tries to really think through what problems he's up against in a very, again, thoughtful way, and tries to get really good information before he makes it, sticks to it, holds to it. And more often than not, he has a good idea or a good plan. He's always prepared. You never see him, you know, oh, Gilbert didn't train properly. Or again, like Dustin Poirier, Gilbert was getting into trouble out of camp. Like, it's just not even a relevant consideration with him. And so the issues for me, again, dude, ready for this one, BC? Jack De La Maddalena, 27. Gilbert Burns, 37. A 10-year gap.
Yeah, where do you think he's at in that? Because 35-year-old Poirier, who's fighting a killer and has been through wars, we're like, well, I don't know if this could be the end. Dude, Gilbert Burns has been through a million wars, Luke, and he still looks the part.
I would say, though, that I don't think Gilbert has been through the wars like Poirier has. Like, you know, does Gilbert have a 5-round equivalent to the Hooker fight? I don't think that he does. Not a 5-rounder.
I mean, he went through hell and might have beaten Chimaev. No one talks about that. No one wants to talk about
that. Exactly. If that had been a 5-round fight, that would be really close, if not worse. But it was only three. So it doesn't fill. So for me, BC, like, first of all, just that gap. I mean, but here's the thing, and it kind of gets back to what I'm saying. Gilbert Burns had some kind of a torn, either, you know, meniscus or not meniscus, I'm sorry, torn labrum or something like that in his shoulder. And rather than get surgery, he did stem cell therapy, which put him out for a while, but he was able to not avoid going under the knife. And dude, here's the thing about Gilbert too. I asked him, he has measurables like VO2 max and everything, like what constitutes physical fitness. He can look at it mathematically on a chart because he can measure the kinds of physical effects that tell you where you're at. And so he knows, if I'm hitting these marks in camp that are being, you know, measured, then I know where I'm at. Like, he always comes in prepared. None of that really, to me, I think Gilbert will be healthy. I think he'll be ready to go. He's obviously got a ton of experience. He can wrestle well. I mean, there's a lot you have to like about his game, but the reality is, at 37 BC, he probably is not the same athlete that he once was. And Jack De La Maddalena is only at this part of his athletic development and technical development as well. He's going to be getting, we always say it, 27. You see these guys when they're 27 and they're better every single time. Ilya Topuria, 27 when his last fight. So to me, BC, it's going, we talked about it with Benoit Saint-Denis and Dustin Poirier, this generational moment. Here's another one at welterweight, where I do believe, you see, we're not a title fight, but I do believe that Gilbert has really defied the odds of age to a pretty significant extent. But I wonder if we're at the end of that road a little bit here, where, again, what is the UFC suggesting by booking a fight like this? Yes, they want to see exactly what they've got with De La Maddalena, and Gilbert Burns will tell you that. But I think that they also probably believe he's got a big, bright future, and they want to set him up for that. We shall see.
FanDuel has Jack De La Maddalena -174, +136 for Gilbert Burns. I think there's a fool's gold element if you want to focus only on Gilbert's age and the fact that he's fresh off that loss to Bilal. There were extenuating circumstances, as you mentioned. So let's, on the flip side, Luke, and find out where we're at with Jack De La Maddalena. I mentioned the streak, 6-0 in the UFC, but coming off of two split decisions, one against Kevin Holland, one in, what was that, like a last minute situation, Luke, when he took on Basil Hafez. Before that, he had four straight finishes in his first four UFC fights. Has he lived fully up to the expectations of where we put him after some of those early finishes, where we said, watch out for him, circle him? I know maybe we're talking more about Bo Nickel, about this prospect, about Chimaev, this guy. Where does Jack De La Maddalena fit in on your radar in terms of when people are coming on? Is he coming the hell on right now, or do you need to see more?
He has not beaten anybody like Gilbert Burns. So winning a bout like this, even for Gilbert at 37, and I agree with you, like that's a young-ish 37, such as you can be. I do think it would be a major, major proving moment, because we just haven't seen him beat someone of this quality and of this caliber. But I mean, I think a couple of extenuating circumstances. Number one, the Basil Hafez fight, that dude is a tank. He was wrestling him the entire time. That was a last minute opponent switch with a completely different style, and he still won. Number one, I want to point that out. And that was like gut check shit. And he took over a little bit late in that one too. So that to me was actually kind of an impressive performance, although a tough one, and one where he had to struggle at times. In the case of Kevin Holland, that was a little bit more of a duel, you know, and he had some disadvantages physically in terms of range that he had to overcome. I also thought he won that one outright, although I do recognize that it was close. But, like, I get that he's facing adversity and you're seeing him struggle with some of that adversity at times, but the lesson I'm taking from this is every time he overcomes it, every time he finds a way, every time he gets through it, and again, at 27 years of age, this is when he's really going to begin to ramp shit up. Also, the other part of his game that I've noticed is the defensive responsibility has gotten better. People point to his combinations, which are good, and his accuracy, which is good, and that all is very flashy and it builds highlights. But this kind of newer style against Holland that you saw that kept him I think safer than he ordinarily had been previously, is not to be discarded. It's going to be very valuable against Gilbert Burns. So listen, I said it one more time. Has he beaten anyone like Burns before? No, no, this would be his best win by a mile, but there's wind at his back, man. Big time.
Do you see the same action potential that I see in this one?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I don't think it's going to be like the Khamzat fight, which was a balls out kind of affair, but Burns, I just don't think, and I think he knows he can't afford, win or lose, you know, his stock didn't drop much at all from the Khamzat fight, but what he can't do is have another, I mean, that performance against Bilal, yes, he was injured, of course, but if you have some other kind of lackluster fight, whether it's due to injury or anything else, whether that's fair or it's not, you're 37, you had another fight back-to-back where you didn't look great after a long layoff, he just can't afford that. He cannot afford that, and so as a result, I think that they're going to mix it up heavily. At first, I don't know, but certainly as the longer it goes, you're going to see them open up.
I wonder, though, from a strategic standpoint, because we did identify the smarts on Gilbert Burns that sometimes can be not stated enough because we talk a lot about his action willingness and his well-rounded game. But look, January of 23, which is not long ago, he went in there against Neil Magny and put on a grappling showcase to remind us that if he wants to lean in those areas, he can absolutely dominate. Took Magny down, just controlled him, submitted him. Is there an opening there against Jack De La Maddalena to use that veteran skill set the same way Glover Teixeira was able to extend his career by leaning on the fundamentals?
Yes, there's no doubt in my mind that's what he's going to be trying. Again, I think Gilbert's going to be better on his feet than you might imagine, but that just seems unlikely. If the fight is fully contested on the feet, like that's the best chance for Gilbert? I don't think so. Mixing it up at times, potentially, right? Could land some good shots, of course, but just over the course of 15 minutes, I just don't find that likely. Whatever, what I do find potentially likely, however, is that if he can establish a takedown threat and really make Jack De La Maddalena work, he's going to have, just a massively better shot. I think that, you know, the fights like Ramazan, Ameev, I'm not putting him on the level of Gilbert Burns, but that was one of the earlier tests about his takedown defense and how much he got better. I think it's probably going to be very, very good. He's apparently working with Craig Jones for this camp. I watched Craig Jones' wall takedown defensive tutorial. It's very, very good, very thorough. So, you know, Gilbert's going to have his work cut out for him too. Make no mistake about it. But like, to the extent that's the central battle. That's not the only battle, but so many things are downstream from that battle that that's going to be the one to pay attention to.
Dude, I love Mr. Bob Dabalina, Maddalena here, Luke, great fighter, but if
I think
one
it's
of
Black
the
Betty Bam Balam.
Yeah, by the band Ram Jam, by the way. Luke, if you can lean on one veteran on this card, I'm going to lean on Gilbert to pull the upset here. Of all these matchups where it's close, it's well-matched, I like Gilbert's chances in this one. We're going to see if he can, he can turn it back, man. That's a big fight,
possible,
big matchup.
Yes.
To open this card, nobody's talking about this one. Former champion Piotr Jan at bantamweight, Song Yadong, the riser, one of Mr. Faber's kids who's just about all grown up. But for the 31-year-old Piotr Jan, Luke, I mean, eesh, brother, he's fighting still super elite competition, but the former champ has lost four of his last five, including three straight. But in that five-fight stretch where he's lost four times, there was the DQ loss to Aljo, the split decision loss in the rematch, the split decision loss to O'Malley, and then a more wide unanimous decision loss to Merab. Luke, at 31, where is Piotr Jan right now? What is his status? Does he still have it? Is this the product of fighting the best in the sport's best division?
And getting a little bit unlucky. So let's go through it. He, in 2021, he fights Aljamain Sterling in a fight that he is winning, in my judgment. I don't think there's really much question about that. In round four, he knees him in the head very, very stupidly and then loses the bout via disqualification, right? From the illegal knee. So that was a bout that he was winning, but he made a stupid mistake and he lost it. He has a fight against Corey Sandhagen and that later that year, he wins it. He wins it outright too. Then he goes back to the Sterling fight. Now Sterling really raised his game in that one. And I thought Jan lost that one fair and square. It was close at times, but fair enough, he got beat there, and there's nothing you can really say much about that. The O'Malley fight, I thought he won, and I think a lot of online observers thought he won. It's close. I'm not saying it's a robbery. It's a close fight, but I thought he won it. I thought he won it 2-3. And then Merab is simply overwhelming. So, like, I give Sterling credit for raising his game in the rematch fair and square. Merab, there's just too much he can do. He's going to be a really tough fight for anybody. But the other fights, I don't really read too much into. I mean, he had the Corey Sandhagen win put in between there. So, I mean, I respect what Sean O'Malley did in the Jan fight. He showed up in ways I didn't think he would, but I don't think he won that fight. I think Jan won that fight. So, to me, I got to tell you, what psychologically it could mean to have that many L's on his record, it may impact his performance, and maybe he is burned out. Like, there could be several factors related to the actual losing that transpired that could affect his performance on Saturday. But I don't see him as, like, on some massive slip. I don't see him as some guy who, like, you can look at his game and it's, like, massively deteriorated. It didn't look great against Merab, but that's Merab, and that's the last fight. But it's hard to look good against him when Merab is just sort of moving downhill on you. In other words, BC, yeah. I still favor, I don't know what the odds are, but I favor him to beat Song Yadong, and I think Song Yadong has not beaten a guy like this. This is the best shot for Song Yadong to get him on this losing streak. Like, this is coming off that Ricky Simone win. So I like the matchmaking. This was supposed to be a main event previously for one of the fight nights they had, right? But everyone being like, oh, Jan, the 3-5 losing streak, hasn't looked great in forever. I'm like, yeah, that's not quite accurate. He looked good fairly recently.
He fought all killers in that 5-fight stretch. I mean, all killers, you know what I mean? And when you look at the odds, man, that's a virtual pick-em. Minus 120, Jan is your barely an underdog. Or I'm sorry, that makes him the favorite, excuse me. And then you have Song Yadong minus 106 as the slight underdog. So a virtual pick-em. Yadong is now 26 years old. To your point, does he have a win on this level? Well, yes and no. He does have a 2020 win over Marlon Vera that was, I would say, disputed at the time in a close 3-round fight. But then he goes and he loses to Kyler Phillips the next time. But since then, he's 5-1 overall since that Kyler Phillips loss. The only loss was the stoppage to Corey Sandhagen, knocks out Ricky Simone, scores a 5-round decision over Chris Gutierrez. He had finished Marlon Moraes during that stretch, finished Julio Arce. I mean, look, he's coming on to a certain degree, but it is perfect matchmaking in the who's coming and going crossroads element. No different than Poirier, BSD, Gilbert Burns, JDM. This is to find out if the aging veteran still has it or if the kid is ready, man. Fireworks. I do, though, to echo what you said, will this make a more desperate Jan giving the losing skid where he feels in this 15-minute window he's got to come in there and prove a lot? I wonder how that impacts the fight.
I think the thing I'd be looking for is somewhat related to that, but a little bit different. Sometimes Jan is a bit of a slow starter. 3-round contest, you're not going to have too much leeway to play with that. I think that has cost him at times in certain ways, but it's also kind of essential to him downloading and whatnot. I think it'll be fine if in the end he is still who I think he is. He takes some time to download. And then I just see him having way more weapons than Song Yadong. Song Yadong has certainly gotten better, but still is, to me, a little bit desperate with his offense. Jan has more of it, has more ways to weave it in, certainly much more battle-tested as well. But I'd be curious to see how he plays this game. Has he worked on getting a quicker start? Has he worked on different ways that have kind of messed him up a little bit in previous encounters? Has he worked on some of those things? That, to me, is going to be kind of important here to be a little bit less error-prone and a little bit less lackadaisical in terms of his urgency to fight. Those are the things I'm looking for.
Look quickly on this undercard, and it's very well matched. This whole card is so well matched. The preliminary feature bout that we mentioned off the top at heavyweight that could and likely will produce the next interim heavyweight title challenger is Curtis Blaydes against Jalton Almeida. Right now, FanDuel has them both at minus 113, so a pick'em there at heavyweight. What should we watch for in this matchup?
Takedown or bust for Jalton Almeida. Can he get it? Can he hold it? What can he do with it? Remember the ground and pound if he ends up underneath. Remember that Curtis Blaydes shattered the face, basically, of Alistair Overeem with those elbows. He would be devastating on top. I mean, again, situation where Jalton Almeida has a real big advantage in one key part of the game, and there's no denying he's got it. But he's got a disadvantage in basically every other one. Curtis Blaydes should win this, but he's got to be on point. He's made errors, costly ones at times, against difficult opponents. I want to see him on his P's and Q's in this one.
Pick'em fight. Can't wait to see it. Would love both of those guys against Aspinall in a full fight. we may end up going down that road and finding it out, because, you know, if we still do John and Stipe, I mean, what are we doing here? Quickly on the name change you shot out at me before the show started, Caitlin Chookagian, the blonde fighter, Luke, 35-year-old veteran at 125, changing her surname to Sermonera, her married name, and she'll bring that married name into an interesting matchup with 25-year-old Macy Barber, who's somehow still that young, Luke. But she has won 5 in a row since that 2-fight losing streak to Roxanne Modafferi by big upset. And then, of course, the decision loss to Alexa Grasso before Grasso was able to change, you know, end up going on her run to the title here. She's beating some decent names, Luke, and she's coming off a stoppage of Amanda Ribas. Is it time for Macy Barber if she gets past the formerly known Chookagian on Saturday?
Chookagian, tough fighter, super experienced, manages range and distance very well. But as you mentioned, those 5 wins in a row for Macy Barber. And by the way, 35 versus 25 in the age, another 10-year gap. You had 37-27 with Gilbert and JDM. So another interesting, we said it before, a lot of like who's coming, who's going, who's old, who's young, clashes generationally. This is another one. I do feel like, though, Macy Barber was a... She had, you know, it was big and loud about who she was going to be very early, hit a couple roadblocks, had a bit of a slow-ish start from that, but in their last couple of fights against Andrea Lee and then Amanda Ribas, I thought she, and I know the one against Lee was a bit of a split decision, but I still think she's really began to turn it on. She looked good against Ribas, tough, durable. This is a great opportunity for her because Chookagian knows how to win rounds. She knows how to disengage and make everyone fight on her terms. Right, which changes the whole ball game for me. Barber, can she get away from that and find a way to get the fight on her terms? We shall see.
I like this lightweight tilt. Mateus Gamrot will be a 4-1 betting favorite against 39-year-old Rafael Dos Anjos, the aging veteran who has lost 2 of 3, but is always game. I'm going to be watching that closely. Luke, are you dialed into the early prelims when we get heavyweight Robles Despaigne, who's going to make his debut here against Josh Parisian? This is a 35-year-old, 6'7" Cuban known as the Bad Boy, who is a freak athlete with a freak reach. I believe this is a UFC record reach. Tell me if I'm wrong. This side of
it's the Sergei longest Pavlovich. Reach in UFC history. Yes. Longer than 7-foot semi shield. Mm-hmm.
87 inches here for the 6'7" frame. Josh Parisian seems about right for that, like, you know, slam that they're going to bring to the slaughter to find out if this guy is the next Henan Ferreira, Luke. Maybe he is, maybe he isn't, but it is something to watch here on this early prelim.
I mean, Robles is super untested. I mean, could not be less tested in MMA. I mean, obviously he was very accomplished in Taekwondo, but like in MMA, my man is like outrageously untested. So like either he's going to win spectacularly or BC, if there's any question about his game, and he loses to Parisian, which, by the way, is I don't really know. We don't know shit about this dude's MMA game. But, like, if it ends up being, like, woefully inadequate, we can't be surprised. You just can't be.
Minus 340, Despaigne is the favorite. But that's an interesting betting fight should he walk in there and have a lot of issues. We're going to find out. A couple other matchups. I just want to mention Michel Pereira against Michal Olyshakchyk is going to be all action. Iwan Kutalaba's back against Felipe Lins at light heavyweight. A few other okay ones there to turn out, Luke. The curtain jerk.
You buried the lead. The Pedro Munhoz 135 fight over Kyler Phillips. Kyler Phillips has impressed me. He doesn't have a big name yet, but he has of recently looked much better than I ever thought he would. That's a quietly important fight for the bantamweight division.
Yeah, he's fresh off that decision win over Hione Barcelos. He has a win over Song Yadong, as we mentioned earlier. Great card on Saturday, man. Can't wait. Luke, will we have an MK post product on Saturday?
We certainly will. The UFC 299 post-fight show right here, youtube.com/morningcombat. Keep it locked, bitches.
That's Luke Thomas. I'm Brian Campbell. Mikey Mormile, CBS on the ones and twos. Thank you for watching. Luke, people are debating whether us taking some time off was worth it. It wasn't worth it. It was necessary. And we're about to bang all of our listeners.
Yeah, I mean, there it could be the case, BC, that we didn't really have a choice and we kind of had to. Well, that's a little strong, too.
But we were fighting to save this show, Luke, okay?
Yeah, right? Yeah. I mean, I don't think folks really understand. Like, some of the things we made, we didn't have great choices. But either way, news headed your way soon. Stay tuned.
Tui, bang. That's the story. Thank you for watching. We are out of here.